Hello, this is Josh Hankin from SandbagFitnessSystems.com, and today I'm very excited to have Stephen Morris of ExplosiveFootballTraining.com with me today. Hey, Stephen, how are you doing?
Good, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I actually asked Stephen to be on the call after basically seeing one of his articles on Elite about football training, and he did mention sandbags in his list, and I was kind of piqued that someone was so open-minded about it. His training programs have been basically featured in magazines such as Figure Athlete, Elite, Milo, Staley Training, and a lot more. He's been lifting in the industry for over 15 years and a strength coach in the Philadelphia and South Jersey area. So, Steve, I'd like to thank you for joining us today and just hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about what explosive football training is and what you've been up to.
All right. Basically, we train football players. We try to take I hate to use the word holistic, but I guess it is a bit of a holistic approach. It's a lot of weights, but I like to do what I call closing the gaps, which is finding ways to train an athlete to take what they've gained in the weight room and put it on the playing field. And things like sandbags, sleds, awkward lifting objects, those kind of things, those are the things that take what you make in the weight room and you're able to transfer it to the field. Basically, when I was in high school and in college, I played football with so many guys who were just weight room insanely strong. But then they just couldn't get it going on the field, you know. They'd be 500-pound squatters. They couldn't move. They couldn't get out of their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of linemen like that. They couldn't block, couldn't move guys out of the way. They just didn't have those little pieces of strength that you need to actually move a live opponent versus a barbell. So that's where we went. I started developing the system then and just kind of evolved over the years. So it is a lot of things like sandbag training. I love to use sleds and the prowler and farmer's walk bars. I guess you would call it powerlifting meets strongman with a little bit of Olympic lifting and bodybuilding sprinkled in.
And I think that's, like, really a great system. That's something we do a lot of as well in my clinic here in Phoenix. Because I think when people read, you know, maybe like an article that you wrote or they hear something like that, you know, I think the trend is to be one or the other. Either you do strongman, you do powerlifting, you do Olympic lifting, and you're actually integrating all these great techniques. So how do you basically, now what's a program for you like? How do you start, let's say, for example, a high school athlete? We got a lot of dads and coaches out there that work with high school athletes. How do you start them in their progression and training for football?
Well, if they're brand new, we sort of introduce them to the lifts. So teach them how to squat, deadlift. Sometimes we'll do the power cleans, but that's usually a little further along once they build up a nice base of strength. But I guess the beginning phases would look a lot like a very basic powerlifting program. A lot of squats, a lot of deadlifts. They will do some bench, though I prefer incline, especially for football players, because it has the more natural pressing arc that you would use on the field, especially if you were blocking somebody. Sandbags, we start them light. I like to get that stuff early, sandbags and sleds, because you got to start building their general preparation, and you got to start fixing leaks before they even begin. I just saw too many training programs that would have guys doing crunches and all these crazy, really sissy ab exercises. Nothing's going to train your abs like doing a sandbag clean and press, doing a deadlift or a front squat. So I guess that would be the core training phase of it. But it's very basic in the beginning. Keep getting them stronger. As people progress, I'm a big favorite of the conjugate periodization scheduling. But in the beginning, it's a very basic five sets of five. You know, if everybody went out and just followed Bill Starr's recommendations from The Strongest Shall Survive for the first year, you'd be light years above and beyond, you know, beyond anybody else. And then as you get your base, then you start moving on to the more complex stuff. So, yeah, in the beginning, it would pretty much be 3 days a week, typically an upper day, a lower day, and then a day that kind of goes with both. So, and the third day would usually have something like a sandbag and something like a prowler push or pull, or some farmer's walk, some very general intro to strongman kind of stuff.
Now, you know, tell me if I'm correct here, because I know what I'm hearing is that, you know, the initial phase, basically you're introducing technique and proficiency in the strength lifts, and by implementing things like sleds, sandbags, and other implements, you're starting to build that base of tendon and ligament strength. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, that's so under-trained in most young people, and really all a lot of trainees. You know, you need the reps in the beginning with the big exercises, just because you got to learn it. Your brain has to become accustomed to actually putting the body through the motion of a deadlift, of a front squat, of even something simple, fairly simple like a bench press. You know, you need practice. But in the meantime, you know, you're not really lifting heavy weights at that time. So it's a good time to start conditioning the rest of the body through odd objects, through sleds. You can start pushing, like especially with a sled. I mean, it's non-weight bearing. It's not going to hurt your joints, even if it's a young athlete. So you can really start pushing the prowler around. You can start pulling sleds. You can start pushing yourself a little bit weight-wise without worrying about injuring yourself, without worrying about – there's not a lot of form to pulling a sled. So you just get out and pull the thing. And that starts to build up, like you said, the ligaments, the tendons, and you start to really create that base that you're going to build upon. You know, just a few months down the road, you'll be getting into the – the really the heavier stuff, the more intense stuff, and I guess you would call it the advanced stuff.
And just sort of taking that line of progression, you know, what's heavy for, let's say, a freshman sophomore type of a football player? You know, what type of range are you looking at? You know, are you even really going that heavy?
It depends on their physical maturity. I mean, a great example is I've had freshmen who came in, you know, and they're 5'1", 120 pounds. I mean, in contrast to that, with me as a freshman in high school, I was 6 foot and 260.
So, wow.
Yeah. I mean, I was chubby back then, but, you know, I had a greater body mass. I was able to handle the heavy stuff a lot faster, and I progressed a lot faster. So it's going to be independent. It's going to be, you know, sort of dependent on their physical maturity. But freshman year, sophomore year even, it's not a time to start getting crazy with the weights. Like I said, your freshman year, you're probably, if you're working with me, you're going to be doing a lot of fives. So, you know, I like fives for that because it's middle of the road. You're getting some reps in, but it's not doing bodybuilding. But, you know, you can go fairly heavy, but you're not going to hurt yourself on a set of fives like you would attempting a max when you're 13 years old. As you get to sophomore, yeah, you might drop down. You might start doing threes, and then once you're, it really depends on the progress they're making. They're making good progress. They're putting weight on or taking it off, whatever their goal is. Then we'll start getting into the working up and doing max effort work, where you're working up to say it. I typically, unless it's maybe a college kid, high school as they get older, I won't start getting into the working up to singles until I really feel they're ready. So we'll probably cap it at doubles and triples. But for the most part, yeah, we start off at fives. I can't really give you a weight range as far as what heavy
sure.
is. It's just, I guess you just got to go by feel. You know, like I said, five is a good number because you got to push it, but you're not going to push it to the point where you're going to really hurt yourself.
Well, let me ask you then, because I know it's always impossible to, especially with kids, to do percentage-based training because obviously they change so much day-to-day, I find. I don't know if you've had that same experience. But,
right.
You know, when you're saying things like triples and fives, you know, I think it's important to distinguish. You're not always saying that. I mean, it doesn't have to always be all-out triple or all-out five, right? I mean, it could be, you know, building up to those where one set maybe is a top effort, right?
Right. Basically, I think a lot of people misunderstand it started with the Bulgarian model in Olympic lifting. Everybody said, oh, they max out every session of every day. And then when Westside got popular, they said the same thing. They go, oh, it's no way you could do this. You're maxing out every day. You're really not. You're going up to whatever you're capable of that day. So, you know, let's say you got a kid and his best triple in the squat is 200 pounds. He may not hit that every time. Sometimes it may be 185. Some days he may be extra good and hit 210. You got to go by how you feel that day. You got to go by, you know, especially high school and college, you got school issues, you got family issues, you got all these things tugging at the resource pool of energy So you can't just say, all right, today's 80%. You're going to do 80% whether you want to or not, because it's going to either lead to injuries, burnout, and the main thing, disappointment. Because I went through a college phase like that where a college coach had to say, you've got to do 90% today. And, you know, sometimes you're just not up to it. And sometimes 90% is light and you really want to go 95. But that's why I like that whole West Side style of going where you need to go that day. And it's really a matter of when it comes to that, you just want to strain against the bar. Dave Tate talks about that a lot. You want to get that strain, that 2 or 3 seconds that it takes to complete the lift. It's not so much about the weight on a max effort day. It's more about the amount of intensity, the amount of effort that's put into it. That's what's going to build the strength.
Okay, so I mean, and especially with younger athletes, and we can move up maybe to like the upperclassmen now, you know, I think that once they have that grooved lift, they have some proficiency, then that's when you can start seeing how they handle different types of heavier loading, because I think even the word maximal strength tends to carry that inference of, you know, 100% effort. But, you know, with the juniors and seniors, you still may only go 100% once in a blue moon. You're still probably, what, in the 75-85% range most of the time, or, you know, a good effort type of feel?
That would pretty much be the range, 75-85. I think once you can get to the point where you're training at around 85% of your max most of the time, you're in an advanced level.
Mm-hmm.
So 75-85 would be real good. And you know, listen, I usually work with small groups. So if you were training with me and you're a junior and you're just not feeling it, we'll go lighter. I mean, it's not, you know, we're supposed to make progress. You're not supposed to be torturing yourself with this stuff.
Well, and that makes sense. I mean, you know, do you think that's one of the biggest mistakes a lot, you know, especially high school coaches do? I mean, I've seen the trend, and I'm sure you have to some degree, of these coaches that are trying to produce, you know, basically high school combines. And it seems like there's a lot of pressure on these coaches to see the kids, you know, do big weights, you know, for their training. And if they're not producing the big weights, I mean, these kids almost stress out about being able to go into their offseason and hit 225 for 15 times. Have you found that? And do you think that's a big-time mistake for these coaches in their offseason use?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have an article that will be coming out on Elite at some point. It's about how we test real world for football. And I hate the combines. I have athletes who have to go, it's necessary.
Sure.
You know, you have to do it. I hate to do it. I think the 225 bench test is just ridiculous. I mean, it's a strength endurance test. Even things like 40, you know, all these tests are just so, they're not really based in anything with football. So yeah, a lot of times coaches will come up to me or they'll email me and they'll say, I don't understand what's happening. I'm following X program and I'm following it to the letter and my guys are starting to go backwards. Number one, I'm not a big fan of programs in general. I like templates, because in a template, you can vary things. You can go by the feel of the athlete. You can go by a ton of things. I mean, if it's finals week, your athletes are going to be tired.
Mm-hmm.
If it's right before a vacation, like spring break, then they usually have a little extra energy because they're psyched up to get out of school for a while. So, you know, you got to go with the ebb and flow of real life rather than what it says on a piece of paper.
And is that why you like the conjugate method so much for these athletes? Because there's a little self-regulation in there?
Yeah, I mean, years ago, I had a real disconnect. I had a real good high school strength coach. And then I went to college, and it was like, what's going on here? I mean, these guys were like 3 sets of 10, and then another guy came in, and he was strict percentage, and I started to slide backwards. I mean, I was, for a high school kid, I was pretty strong, and then I hit a 2 or 3 year period there where I was just like, I didn't know what was going on. And then I started to get into this, reading Louis Simmons articles, and, you know, I started to see like, oh, you don't have to hit 90% just because a paper tells you. You're tired today. Don't do it. I'll give you a personal example. Like right now, I have some, I had two shoulder cuff injuries, rotator cuff injuries. For a while, I had to really play it by ear as far as whenever I did upper body work, if my shoulders were hurting, I wasn't going to push it to the point where I was going to re-injure them and then just make the whole process of rehabilitating longer. When I learned to, like, just back off and say, all right, you know, maybe 75% is the tops today, then things started to heal and my upper body exercises started to get back to where they were pre-injury and then above. So, yes, the conjugate method allows you to just go with the flow of the way you're feeling. I hate to say instinctual training because that brings up, you know, the bodybuilding magazines. But that's a good reason why you should have a coach there to guide you through it.
Well, I think, you know, too, Mel Stiff, you know, use the term cybernetic periodization, basically, you know, rating yourself on technique and, you know, I guess, you know, what you're saying, how you feel. So, I mean, that this concept is not, you know, like you said, it's not the bodybuilding thing of just, you know, go, you know, just let's go wing it. You have a template that you're working from, it sounds like, and then you're adjusting it as the workout goes on. Because we've all had those workouts where you go in and you just go, wow, it's just not happening today. And, you right. know, that, I think that gives you a lot of valuable feedback as a coach, right? I mean, that tells you a lot about your athlete.
Yeah. I mean, as I'm sure as you know, if you coach athletes, you know right away if they didn't sleep well the night before. Because they may have their strength, but their snap, their pop is just gone. You know, they got no explosiveness. So you got to know that day. You got to back them off a little bit. Or what I learned from reading Bill Starr's older articles was during those times where it's going to be a while where they're going to be sleep deprived, maybe finals, maybe midterms, whatever, get them in, get their main exercise and maybe one accessory and get them out. Because there's just times when sticking to the program is just it's not a smart thing to do. You know, you're actually going to go backwards. So, yeah, you got to just play it by ear. You got to feel it. And once you coach athletes for a while, and, you know, once you've got somebody under your supervision, under your coaching, you start to get to know them. You get to know their sort of cycles of energy up and down. So that makes it a lot easier to get the progress moving rather than just saying, you know what, so-and-so told me to do X percentage, and that's what we're going to do, and that's it.
And then, you know, let's go back a little bit to you're talking about, you know, that we were talking about the combines briefly, especially for, you know, younger athletes. You know, because high schools have more control, like you said, I mean, you know, in the NFL, you just got to do what you got to do.
Right.
High school coaches, if they want to set up standards to which to test their athletes by and to show progress, you know, what would you recommend that these coaches test for?
Well, I outlined this quite a bit in the article. It's number one, as far as weight room strength, you can stick to the basics. I mean, I think if you tested a deadlift, you know, right, a deadlift, a squat, it's just like a powerlifting meet, deadlift, squat, and I would say incline. You don't have to go super heavy. You could test them on a 3-rep max. This way, you know, you get guys away from going crazy and trying to impress you and hurting themselves. Anything in the weight room is fine with that. I think the much bigger disconnect comes from these guys with the combines, with the 40-yard dash and the 20-yard shuttle. And I was watching ESPN a while ago, and they had one of those NFL Films profiles of the behind the scenes of the combines, and they're measuring guys' hands to see if they're big enough to catch a football. Well, how about you just throw them the football and see if they can catch it? You know, and not to get off the thing, but in the NFL, these guys are coming out of high school and college. You had 8 years of game film. If you can't tell if a kid is a good football player from 8 years of game film, I don't know what a 20-yard shuttle is going to tell you. I mean, they're not going to suddenly, from the day they graduate to the day they hit the combine, become great football players. And
right.
I'm sure you've seen it every year. You got these guys who go to the combine, and they test off the charts, running a 4.340, you know, and defensive backs bench pressing 225 for 20 reps, and then they never play in the NFL because they're good at taking the test, not good at playing football. So as far as testing, sometimes you just got to get the kids out and just have them play. Like one form of conditioning I like to do is it was called metabolic training. I read about it years ago from the University of Nebraska, back when Nebraska was the be-all, end-all. And it basically goes like this. If you're a tight end, you're going to condition like a tight end. You're going to line up. You're going to run 10 pass routes in a row. And you're going to have a quarterback throw you the ball. you take a little rest, and you'll do it again. You'll repeat it five times. It's a great form of conditioning because you're actually playing the sport. Well, if you get a defensive back or a linebacker covering him, and you get a few guys, I guess in football you would call it pass scully, where you just have the receivers and the D-backs and stuff. Videotape it. Watch the tape. Are your defensive backs closing in on the ball? Are your receivers making fast breaks? That's the true test, because that's what goes on the field. I don't care what your 40 is. I mean, very rarely do you just line up and run 40 yards. Maybe on special teams, you know, the gunners on a punt team, but honestly, it's much more about whether or not you can make the break, whether your linebackers can blitz fast enough, whether they can get, linemen can get out of the stance. So it's a little involved, and it takes a little coaching, but you got to just actually put them in game-like situations, videotape it, compare videotapes. Are they moving faster than they did 3 weeks ago? If they are, then you're on the right track. If they're going backwards, then maybe they're tired, or maybe you're not, you know, maybe they're not putting the work in. I guess the only traditional test, the 20-yard pro shuttle is not bad. At least it gets you moving from side to side. But again, we've all seen the combine videos and the specific ways to train for it so that you get a faster time, but you may not necessarily be faster. You're driving out of the hole faster. You're hitting yang. You know, you're doing all the little things that make the difference on the stopwatch, but it may not mean you're actually improving as a football player. So it sounds a little weird, but yeah, the best way to do it is set up any kind of game-like situations and watch the film, see where they're going from there.
That's sound advice, because, you know, it's gotten to the point where, you know, these athletes have a lot on the line, are hiring sprint coaches to teach them how to run their 40, and that has nothing to do with actually lining up on the field.
Right.
So it's almost like they're starting to do an open book test, and then they're not going to really know the information. And it seems, too, I know one thing I've always heard from a lot of coaches is that the things that don't get a lot of publicity in the combines are all the skills tests. And, you know, that I think that is what the coaches actually look at more, because I've heard some NFL coaches say, well, we just look to see if they can bench enough. After a certain point, they don't care anymore. So it sounds like your system is a little more integrated. So have you had high school coaches come in and go and change what they've been doing? Because, I mean, you and I are familiar with things like, you know, coach come in and go, well, we're going to have the 500-pound squat club and things like that. Do you still encourage that? Because, you know, you want to give the kids incentive, right? I mean, you want to have – so it sounds like you're looking at a balance of the two.
Right. You definitely I'm a big believer in record boards and anything, you know, as long as you got weight classes, you know, you don't want the 280-pound lineman being the top guy because he's the biggest, and then you got, you know, a defensive back never making the record board because he's 130 pounds. Give him weight classes, give him, you know, standards to hit. And, it's the old classics, the 200-pound bench club, the 300, the 400-pound squat. We had all that. And it was always enjoyable because there was always something that somebody could hit. If you weren't a good squatter, maybe you were a good deadlifter, you know, and you always got your name up there. And as you know, the longer you coach athletes, the more you learn this. Progress is the greatest motivator. If you give them a way that they can see that they're progressing, they're way more likely to come back time and time again. Because, you know, I'd like to think that everybody is just gunning to come in the weight room and start lifting. But the truth is, not everybody's all that into weightlifting. You know, a lot of these guys aren't that into the training aspect. They do it because they have to. But they start getting progress, and you go, you know what, this is actually kind of fun.
Well, yeah, I always said that a lot of people have the misinterpretation that athletes enjoy lifting. They enjoy playing their sport. They don't necessarily enjoy training for it.
Right.
And along that line, you know, so once you've gotten the kids, you know, and I'm sure you deal with some college kids too, what's the biggest difference between, you see, a upperclassman high school kid and a kid, you know, in a Division I or a high-level college program as far as their football skills and development physically?
Well, the college kids will always have better recovery ability. They're older. They got more testosterone. Usually they have a much better schedule in that, you know, a high school kid, when you're in high school, you don't think about it at the time, but you're basically, you have the hours of a full-time job, then you go lift, or, you know, some kids play 2-3 sports. So you're at school from 7 o'clock to 2:30, then you got maybe half an hour to get dressed, and then you're right back out on the field. you're really tapping into your energy reserves, plus just the energy that you use by being growing at that age. Then you go to college, and it's like, oh, I got a 12 o'clock class today. Tomorrow's off. They got a lot more time. They have more resources. Typically, if they have a meal plan, they get better food than they got in high school at the cafeteria. Recovery ability is probably the main factor, which is why you see college programs are so much more involved and so much harder. They can recover from it, you know. High school kids just don't have it in them to start doing, 5 days a week where they're hammering away every single day. It's just not possible.
Right. Well, go ahead.
In my own case, I mean, I was definitely an advanced lifter even at high school. But it took me a long time to transition from going 3 days a week to four. Because when my first experiment with 4 days a week, my coach and I in high school, my senior year after football was like going in towards the end of my senior year. I was still only 17, but it was just, I couldn't do it. And then as I got a little older, 19, into college, then I could start doing four, and then everything progressed a lot. But, you know, you can't rush it. It'll happen when it happens, basically.
So how, as you go through the different levels of your program, do you start seeing an emphasis change from, you know, the basic lifts to a little more strongman to a little Olympic lifting? You know, how is that actually, how do you start differentiating when to use different systems? Because I know a lot of coaches feel stressed that they need to be throwing everything in at once. They want to do plyos, they want to do strongman, they want to do powerlifting. How do you have a sort of a sequence that different levels generally start hitting different phases?
Yeah, the basics will be the power lifts plus some of the more common accessories like incline, basic rows, one-arm row, that sort of thing. It's very, very basic, something you would have seen maybe, you know, back when John McCollum was writing for Strength and Health, like those kind of exercises. Then as they progress, then we start getting into the more specialized, something like you'd see we start rotating exercises on your heavy day. So you may do front squats for 3 weeks, and then you're going to go and you're going to do safety squat bar for 3 weeks, and then, you know, the next 3 weeks maybe it could be a snatch grip deadlift. So then we start getting into the variations. And then the more you progress, basically as the progression goes, you'll cycle through faster. The more closer to advanced you get, the more you cycle the exercises. So in the beginning, you're going to stick with them a while. Sets and reps may change, but if you're squatting and you're front squatting, that's what you're doing for a while. As you get to the point where you've been lifting 4, 5, 6 years or whatever, or maybe less, but you're progressing faster physically, then it may be every 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks of squat, 2 weeks of front squat, 2 weeks of deadlifting. And then as you get to the real advanced level, you know, like where I'm at now, I pretty much cycle through exercises weekly.
And that's with how many years of training, though? I mean, I'm training pretty consistently, too, I imagine.
You've
got to be like 20 years?
It was around 14, maybe.
Okay.
That I started to do the every week. I mean, I stuck with 3 weeks at a time until it just wasn't progressing anymore. And then when I started to change more frequently, then things got going again. But as you know, the longer you've been lifting, the more tricks you got to pull out of your hat to get things going.
Absolutely. And what's your opinion about the controversy? Because I know there's a lot of controversy with coaches. Obviously, everyone's trying to do both what they believe in and maybe what they have a bias towards. You know, you seem pretty diplomatic about the use of powerlifting and strongman and Olympic weightlifting. I mean, I guess the biggest controversy is some people are, hey, you should do Olympic lifting. Some people say it has no carryover to sports. What's your opinion upon, you know, those type of arguments?
Well, I think every one of the iron sports, if you want to call them all different sports, strongman, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, and even bodybuilding, there's a place for it. You know, if I have a skinny athlete and they need to gain weight, some of their assistance exercises are going to look like the set and rep scheme of a bodybuilder. It's going to be 3 sets of 8. It's going to be 4 sets of 8. Sometimes we'll even do like Joe DeFranco does with the max rep upper body days. Because, hey, if they're skinny and they're naturally skinny, and then you see their parents and they're both tall and lanky, you're like, we got a challenge here.
Right.
We've got to shake the system up. We can't just not a lot of guys can grow off the low reps, so you got to use some bodybuilding stuff. As far as Olympic lifts, I mean, I competed in it for a long time, so I'm kind of partial to it, but I have a little bit of an advantage because I usually work with small groups. I don't do much team training, so I have a little more time with them. But if it's in a team situation, if the coach has done the Olympic lifts, if they've gone through a USAW course, if they feel comfortable, yeah, you can teach them a power clean. If the coach doesn't really know himself, just forget it. There's plenty of Olympic lift variations you can do. Clean pulls, snatch pulls. You know, if you look at the Olympic lift accessory movements, they're very useful because you look at a snatch pull, you're squeezing off the floor, you get to the knees, and then you got to pop it. You got to explode, get those elbows up like you're trying to knock somebody out. That's a lot like accelerating through a tackle. It's a lot like many sports movements, even in wrestling, taking somebody down. So the accessories are good. Powerlifting, the big knock was always, it makes you slow. Well, as we've seen with the conjugate, the West Side guys, when you do the speed work or when you're doing other things off the field, things like sprinting and pulling sleds, you're going to build your speed up, so I wouldn't worry about that. Basically, even from the start, the main thing I can tell any coach who's working with beginners, teach them to accelerate the bar as fast as they can on every rep. It seems weird because especially when you start doing weights that are a little hard for you, the bar's moving slow, but it's the intent to accelerate it that keeps your body able to produce speed. It's not so much lifting an empty bar as fast as possible. It's moving as much weight as you can as fast as possible. So always try to accelerate the bar as fast as possible. And that's why I think you got to take all pieces into account. You know, some of the more advanced strongman stuff maybe isn't feasible, especially if you're a high school coach and you don't have the equipment for it. But doing a farmer's walk or a sandbag carry or, you know, those kind of things, even if you don't have sleds, get a couple tires and throw some 45s on them and have them pull them around. It's not hard to implement. And if you're confused about how to use strongman stuff, use it on your conditioning days. Believe me, it's a lot more fun than just having them go out and running around aimlessly. The kids will appreciate it, though.
Absolutely. And by the more complex stuff, you're talking about stuff that requires more equipment, like yokes and stuff like that.
Yeah, you get into the yokes. I used to like doing a lot of stone stuff personally, but I would not recommend it for doing with athletes just because, as I think Brooks Kubik said it back in Dinosaur Training, if you drop a rock on your foot, yeah, you're out of commission. If you drop a sandbag, you know, you might feel a little stupid, but you'll be fine.
Absolutely.
So I tend to steer away from things like barrels and rocks. Just go with sandbags. If you get a cheap set of farmer's walk bars, you have some sandbags, and you get a prowler or a sled, you got about all the strongman stuff you'd ever need because there's just so many different variations you can do within that.
Well, and the prowler seems to obviously caught on big time. You know, we have a couple, and they're awesome. My question, though, is do you think there's a right and wrong way to use it? I guess by that I'm talking about a prowler. I mean, because I guess I've watched some videos online, and I don't know. I always think, people forget to look at things when they have something simple like a prowler at body alignment and purpose of the drills. Do you use the prowler exclusively for conditioning, or do you actually use it for speed enhancement as well?
I'm not a big fan of doing weighted stuff for speed enhancement. The jury's still out. I mean, you read some studies and they'll say it's good. You see other ones that says if it alters your running form, then it could actually be detrimental. So I like it for conditioning. So the way I use it is this. You got three ways. If it's just you want to get their general conditioning up, keep it light, have them push it around. They can do it in sets of a minute and rest maybe 20 seconds, or they can just push it for 15, 20 minutes at a shot. It's just a real general conditioning thing, nothing too fancy. It actually aids in recovery because of the blood flow increase. Second way, you load it a little more moderately, and you push it as fast as possible. Now, it's heavy enough so that it's not going to alter running form. You're not going for top speed, but it's classic football conditioning, the sprinting against, a heavyweight. Especially with linemen, as you've seen, the prowler has two poles that are upright. If you get a guy
starting off at the push, at the start of the push, in his same fire out stance that he's going to use to block, he's going to simulate blocking a lot. It's a lot like pushing a blocking sled, you know. Mm-hmm. So you get that going, and that goes fast, relatively fast, I should say. It's basically a sprint, but you know, if you look at people when they're sprinting with a prowler, they're not moving very fast. The third way, and that's more of a once in a while thing, is if you really load the thing up and just go for an all out push. It's not as effective, because what ends up happening is if it gets too heavy, you look like a, you know, you get guys looking like a pig wallowing around in the mud rather than actually making any progress with the damn thing. So as far as how we use it, push it, pull it. I think a good way to use it is, even with a sled, if you don't have a prowler, is to hook a handle on and do the back pedal pull.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not sprinting, but you're moving at a fairly quick pace. And the push, if you're going to pull it, you can hold it. You can either wear a harness. Like, I have the Iron Mind draft pulling harness, but if you don't, you can just pull it with a handle. You can do the one where you lean over, the 45-degree pull. You can do an upright pull. One way I really like to use it is actually as a hamstring training exercise. This can be done right in the middle of a weight training session if it's convenient. You hold the straps up high, and what you do is walk. You do sort of a walk out, nice long stride, and instead of just walking, it's a lot like if you see a cat or a dog walk. If you walk behind an animal, you'll notice that their paws hit and then sort of pull the earth towards them.
Mm-hmm.
The best way I could describe it is, if you're on a treadmill and the treadmill's not on, and you want to walk on it, you have to physically pull it towards you with your feet. That's a good way to train the hamstrings, because it's a lot like running. And in that, I will warn anybody who tries it, you can't go very heavy on it, especially in the beginning, because it will really bust you up. But it's a real good way to use it for the hamstrings.
And I guess, too, I mean, that sort of makes me start thinking there's a big, you know, trend, too, you know, with the whole functional training mantra that came in. You know, how do you integrate bodyweight training? Are you a big bodyweight fan, especially with younger athletes? You know, how do you sort of program all that stuff, if you even do?
Well, what we do basically is, you know, I guess I should preface that with this. I'm not a huge fan of agility training, you know, running through cones and that sort of thing. It's a good warm-up, and it's good with very beginning athletes just to get them used to moving. But after that, it's pretty much worthless. So the main ways we would use, you know, quote-unquote body weight would be things like pull-ups, push-ups, which are still very good exercises, even though they're remedial. I still do them to this day. Sprinting, and if you have access to it, running hill sprints is excellent for athletes of all ages, because you're going up the hill, you're not going to go full speed. So even somebody who's got bad running form, they're very rarely going to hurt their hamstring, because you'll never get to top speed. Other than that, things like body weight lunges, side lunges, I tend to use those as warm-up processes.
Mm-hmm.
It's real good because it gets you moving, gets everything warmed up, gets you loose, and it also gets you used to moving your own body weight around. So a lot of that kind of stuff.
But you mentioned hamstrings a couple of different times. You know, obviously, hamstring pulls are pretty common place, and especially as kids come in weaker and weaker. Do you have sort of a system of prevention of hamstring injuries?
Well, basically, we just work them as hard as possible from the beginning all throughout phases of training. It's you have to work them both in an extension and a flexion form, so things like deadlifts, straight leg deadlifts, Romanian deadlifts, even stuff like pull-throughs, and then I'm not a huge fan of the regular leg curl, so typically we'll do band leg curls seated just to get that motion going. A lot of the hamstrings injuries in football come from the rapid deceleration. You know, you're running at full speed and all of a sudden you got to stop and cut. A lot of times that's what sets up the injury. Basically, a lot of young athletes don't like to stretch.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to do some stretching. I know it's not popular. I don't like passive stretching before a session, but 3 times a week you should be doing some kind of stretching, especially on your hamstrings, especially because the more you train them, the more likely they are to tighten up on you. So I guess the second factor I would say is mainly when I've seen hamstring injuries, people who don't stretch enough. The muscles are already contracted when they're starting, and now they're, you know, they're expecting it to hit that speed burst. When you hit that speed burst, that's when stuff pops. And if you've never had a hamstring injury, it's just, it's one of the most annoying injuries in the world because it stays around forever. And then as soon as you think it's healed, you start running hard again, and air comes. So avoid them at all costs. Stretch, work your hamstrings and your glutes hard, and you should be okay.
So, fine. I mean, again, this goes back to your diplomatic approach. I mean, I think it's Alan Cosgrove that said, you know, we tend to overreact to things, and, you know, when something like stretching comes about, then we say it's all bad, and, you know, it sounds like you found a very moderate approach to implementing everything. Like you said earlier, it's a time and a place and how you implement it. Along those same lines, you know, obviously very another popular training method I see all the time that coaches try to implement is our plyometric training. You know, do you guys spend a lot of time doing that? If so, how do you sort of set your athletes up to actually benefit from it?
If we do, it's very basic. It's a very basic jump, you know, maybe box jumps. I don't think that most athletes need a ton of plyometrics, at least not. I think it's one of the most misapplied facets of training ever. Became popular, you know, it came over from the Soviets, and of course anything Soviet was, you know, top of the line, especially when it's all that stuff first started trickling over. But you got, I've seen programs, high school and even college, where you got guys who clearly are not ready for upper level plyometrics, you know, depth jumps with a rebound. They're too weak. I don't think there's any set strength standard to start plyometrics. Because when you look at kids on a playground, I mean, they're jumping, they're running, they're dropping from the monkey bars, no problems, right? And that's producing forces that are well beyond their body weight. But I've never really been convinced that if you just start jumping on boxes, you're suddenly going to become this great athlete. If you have access to boxes, jump them. At specific periods in the year. But honestly, even the very basic long jump, single leg long jump, triple jump, those kind of things, they're fine. They're enough to get you feeling explosive. And like I said, if you're in the weight room and you're accelerating the bar, you're building explosiveness. If you're doing stuff off the floor like deadlifts, snatch pulls, that's coming from a dead start. There's no reactive strength there. You just got to start that lift. So that's building starting strength. I think that plyometrics are just way overused. Once you get into the college ages, you can start using them. Basic box jumps at certain periods of the year. The only way I will say that I really have seen them make a big impact is as you get older and you start getting into the heavier stuff. If you take maybe 5 or 6 jumps on a box that you're comfortable jumping on just before you start attempting your heavy stuff, your max effort stuff for the day, there does seem to be an improvement in lifting and in your overall explosiveness. But we're talking a few years down the road when you're getting into the doubles and the triples and that sort of thing. I don't think plyometrics are very useful for beginners.
And so, you know, you've given us some awesome information so far. We're winding down, so I really appreciate your time because this has been really cool just to hear someone who works with, you know, athletes and provides them with a lot of success talk about training in depth and to give some, you know, not just criticism, but some, you know, actually helpful information along with it.
Right.
Can you sort of go through the different levels, you know, high school, college, and pro, and talk about maybe briefly maybe the biggest mistakes, you know, athletes in those different levels make and maybe what you would sort of recommend them focus on?
Okay, sure. High school, or even before high school, too many coaches, too many athletes want to start getting advanced too early. You know, everybody always wanted to point to the Eastern Europeans, the Soviets, and how they had these great, mighty sports teams and Olympic teams and Olympic lifting teams. What was always ignored, there was a period of several years of just going through body weight exercises, sprinting, general sports conditioning, going through the motions with the lifts, learning the lifts. So, you know, everybody wants to jump into that advanced level without the base of preparation. So that's the biggest mistake they make early on. biggest mistake college-wise, there's two. Number one, if you were a really good player in high school, don't assume that you can get away with the same stuff going into college, because everybody at college was the really good player at their high school. So you really have to learn to kick it up a notch. You can't rely on just typically, you know, unless your name's Walter Payton or something, you're not going to rely on just your base talent. And as far as the pro goes, I think just you'd be surprised at how many pro guys I talk to that just, they don't even lift weights. They don't train at all.
Really?
Yeah, and they just, well, I mean, at that level, you do have a lot of guys who are just super, super naturally talented, but they're not going to, or if they do, they hire some generic trainer who just trains them like a bodybuilder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you, with them, they're so talented that sometimes just anything that's not going to hurt them is fine. But you just got to continue to improve. You got to continue to look for new things. Because like I said, by the time you get to the pro level, you know, you've been lifting a while. So you're going to be hitting walls more frequently, I guess I would say.
Well, I think, too, the misinterpretation is, I mean, when you're at that level, too, you've been playing so long, I mean, you're almost just rehabbing more than you are trying to do performance enhancement. Is that pretty true?
Yeah, as you get into that level, upper levels of college and pros, you got to start looking more into the restoration stuff, the getting good people who could do art therapy and soft tissue work and basically hold you, put you back together after the game.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, if you ever read Bill Romanowski's book, he evolved as a player by training harder and harder, but the main thing he did was he started to put together a support team that would be able to put him back together.
And what is sort of your restoration, you know, concepts that, you know, maybe that are really simple to implement that a high school coach could have his team do that would be really beneficial?
Stretch. It sounds weird, but if you can get them doing some yoga, that would be pretty good a couple days a week on their off days. Stretching, things like Epsom salt baths, general stuff like just allowing them to go out and do other sports, play basketball as a team, you know, just go out with their friends and play. You know, it's just things that get the blood moving, get them loosened up in between sessions so you don't have all that lactic acid laying around.
That's, you know, and I think, you know, what you basically laid out is a great format for coaches to follow of any level, which is, you know, if I could sort of sum it up, it's train the basics, get good at them, and by basics, it's not necessarily simple, right? I mean, to get good at squats, it's hard.
Right. Basic is not simple. Simple is simple. You know?
Right.
Basic is very hard, and you don't rush that phase.
Yeah. So, you know, if you could summarize a good philosophy for, you know, all coach, or at least, you know, we get a lot of high school coaches asking those questions, what would be a good philosophy to follow?
Start basic, teach them to accelerate on all movements. Don't rush it. Just don't rush it. You know, let them mature at their own level.
And that's, I mean, that's really sound advice. And Steve, you know, we're winding down, and I just want to thank you so much. And if coaches have more questions, if they want to know more about your program and maybe get you to consult with them about setting up their program, how can they reach you?
Sure, they can hit me up on one of my two websites. They can go to the site where I have most of my articles, which is explosivefootballtraining.com. And if they want to check out the entire template laid out, I have the football manual. It's at explosivefootballmanual.com.
And that's really worthwhile because, as you mentioned, having a template, you know, they always say, you know, the great thing about having a system is that it gives you a system to deviate from. So you need to know, basically, have a philosophy, and that, you know, your philosophy is probably one of the most sound I've heard in a long time. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today, and thank you so much. And I really encourage people to check out explosivefootballtrain.com, and, you know, it's very rare to talk to coaches that have not only personal experience, but, you know, experience coaching as well. So thank you again, Steven. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.